Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, where the senior editors of the world's leading libertarian magazine gather each week to argue about what's in the news and what should be in the news. I am Matt Welch, joined on this inaugural eve by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suterman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Happy pre-Biden, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
No, it's not Monday.
It's just Tuesday.
Like immediately.
Spiritually. It's spiritually
in
Monday.
The Biden era. The last fact check of the Trump presidency comes out against Peter Suterman. We're going to talk about the clinically depressing transfer of power here in a moment. But first, Bound by Oath is the name of a documentary podcast by our old friends at the public interest law firm Institute for Justice, which is obsessed with the question of why it's so dang hard to sue government officials, even when they're caught red-handed violating the Constitution. Bound by Oath unpacks governmental immunities through the stories of real people fighting to vindicate their rights. Also includes interviews with the nation's foremost scholars and lawyers. Check out Bound by Oath wherever you find podcasts. You'll be glad you did. All right, 24 hours from the time that we are recording this, Joe Biden will be sworn in to replace Donald Trump and become the 46th president of the United States after a transition period the likes of which human eyes have never seen, at least humans that are alive, culminating with a deadly mob riot inside of the Capitol building on January 6th. Washington, D.C. Has since been, as far as I can tell, converted into something resembling the Green Zone in Iraq or in Baghdad. Massive fencing checkpoints, 25,000 National Guard troops who apparently always have to sleep on marble floors. Meanwhile, the chattering classes are all busy dreaming up new ways to sick the federal government on various demonstrators, journalists, and entire cable news networks. It's all very disturbing, even from 230 miles away, Catherine, or should I say Katniss? You live in the Capitol. how dystopian does it feel up close and personal?
I have not gone downtown to fully engage with the dystopia because, let's be real, when the revolution comes, I will absolutely not be the Katniss. I will be somewhere else, if at all possible, writing words from a bunker. But
you won't be baking incredibly elaborate cake disguises like PETA of Malark.
I mean,
if we're doing Hunger Games, let's
revolutionary baking. I'm here for it. Yeah. I have not seen a lot. I will say my primary sense of DC's authoritarian lockdown has been from the Reverb, from other places around the country, including my mom from the Burbs, who was very freaked out. And I was on the phone with the IRS on Friday, like you do. And the man on the other end of the line was like, hey, I hate to ask this because I live in Portland and I hated it when people asked me this all summer, but I see you're in D.C. Are you okay?
Oh, and I was like, my garden.
Wow, that's a lot for me to process, Scott, from
that
the IRS.
Like straight out of 1984.
So that is my experience of lockdown, inauguration lockdown so far. But our colleague Robbie Suave has like a tank on either end of his street, and the scooters don't work downtown, so he's really suffering.
Is it a tank or is it an MRAP? Because those are different things.
Robbie did say tank, but Robbie has
magnetic pulse.
Robbie said tank, but he has no idea what he's talking about, as scooter is his key made of conveyance.
It's actually a Subaru Outback.
Yeah, it's just a
that he mistook for a tank.
It's like a normal Land Rover.
Did an electromagnetic pulse get rid of the scooter technology,
or
is this part of the shutdown?
This is a thing,
shutdown?
Actually. I mean, like, in D.C., the scooters have to be throttled in certain zones because of speed regulations, and also they shut off when you get too close to the Capitol. So there was already remote scooter shutdown technology, and they have employed it in the whole lockdown zone.
The scooters in D.C. are basically like the robots in Westworld.
Yeah, they just kind of power down. It doesn't look
Except
like anything
to
me.
They're a little more sexually forward. Yeah. Right?
Why do you think Robbie is
the
riding
bird
them?
Scooters in particular?
Peter, you live in D.C. and tend to hang out with the median beltway journalistic Biden supporter. I just tarred you like that. Is there, please tell me, some kind of like sentiment of like, hey, guys, maybe this could be overdoing it a little bit, or like maybe let's not do the Patriot Act 2 tomorrow. Is there any sense that this might be an overreaction, or is everyone all in on the new domestic terrorism?
I mean, if Catherine is Katniss here, I guess that literally makes me PETA in this equation. So I'm
That's gross.
Trying to figure out what
brutally strong, casually strong
be. What my response therefore should be. One answer to your question right now is that I don't hang out with anyone anymore ever, and I may never again. So
no,
you know, my
beltway cocktail parties.
Yeah, there are no cocktail parties. There are no beltway wine shindigs. I have no idea what other people are thinking directly. But I do. I mean, I will say the people who wrote about the overreach of the national security apparatus during the Bush era have been pretty good about saying, hey, let's not do that again. So folks like Spencer Ackerman, who is now at the Daily Beast and who has a book coming out on some of this stuff and has been covering this sort of thing for 15 or 20 years. And the people who saw those mistakes in real time and wrote about them from the left and saw them as mistakes under the Bush administration are certainly concerned about potential overreach here. I don't think that includes everyone. And you have to remember that a lot of the kind of beltway insiders were folks who thought that that stuff basically worked. Like maybe there were some, you know, idiosyncratic, there were kind of administrative difficulties and they should have implemented this program or that program better, run these checkpoints a little bit differently, had different hiring practices, whatever it is. But they basically thought directionally that the post 9/11 security programs were good ideas that worked and should be replicated. And that's, I think, the bigger problem here is that even though amongst libertarians and amongst civil libertarian liberals, there was a widespread recognition that the post 9/11 measures were mistakes, if not outright disasters. That recognition is not widely shared. And also, I think it's pretty clear that that at least some of the sense that it was a failure at the time has kind of receded and was attached to the fact that it was being done by the George W. Bush administration, which some sort of Democratic partisans just opposed it because it was a Bush program. And we're going to see, I think, at least some movement to ramp up that sort of thing again. My hope is that the pushback from the left in particular, from the civil libertarian left, will be stronger this time and that Biden will take seriously his kind of campaign pitch that like, hey, maybe let's not go too big, too extreme immediately in ways that are going to really alienate a lot of the public and be counterproductive based on the early policy, economic policy announcements that we're seeing from him. I'm not sure that that's actually going to define his presidency.
Nick, I want to do a...
Yeah, and if ahead. you toss into that, you know, as Peter was getting at, you know, the large majority or at least plurality of kind of DC power people are, you know, they were all into the Patriot Act. None of them were critical of it. None of them were critical of the national surveillance state. There's also, I think, going to be this weird thing where we kind of forget about the policy specifics of the Obama administration that Joe Biden was, checks notes, vice president during, you know, which was terrible on these kinds of issues. I was just listening to an interview with Obama where he was going, you know, about his new book, and he was going on about how Trump was terrible towards the press, you know, and that it's he was the worst president towards the press ever. And it's like Obama actually jailed his Department of Justice, jailed more or you know, prosecuted more journalists than all of the administrations put together. He lied about, you know, surveillance programs. And, you know, people think, oh, Edward Snowden ratted out the Bush administration. He didn't. Biden is up to his neck in all of this stuff. And that is the consensus in D.C. is that, oh, you know, we need terrorism because, you know, Matt, it's not just a bunch of...
I don't think the consensus is that we need terrorism.
Well, terrorism, we need a new domestic terrorism. And actually, you know, a little terrorism goes a long way, right, to selling programs. But There's going to be this weird amnesia that, like, everything that was bad that was done in the name of national surveillance, security, all of that, that was George Bush, and he was an idiot, and Dick Cheney is evil, and, you know, Halliburton is still, you know, cashing royalty checks from the Iraq War, and they're going to forget the 8 years of Obama, which was, you know, basically a continuation of all the Bush stuff.
Catherine.
Can I drop a little bit of an ENB quote from this morning, Elizabeth Nolan Brown's roundup this morning, in which she just says, kind of casually after a bunch of tweets and stuff, but as Boot and others unfold the plot to reinvigorate the failed war on terror, it seems we may have a lot more to fear from status quo authoritarians than the MAGA nationalist crowd right now. The latter worships a disgraced man who is leaving the White House tomorrow. The former finds friends in the executive branch, Congress, and all the levers of legacy media. That's strong words and not wrong.
All might be a little bit all-encompassing as a word. But Catherine, when I hear, I want you to give me a kind of a grumpy old man check, a midlife crisis check to
I'm here for you
to abut our Slack discussion about the movie Soul, which is great. I don't know, man, like when I hear people, whether it's Biden or even whether it's like people who are supporting the Stop the Steal until last second, when I hear anyone right now talk about the need to for unity in an unironic way, or Lord knows anyone getting excited about Garth Brooks or Lady Gaga performing, let alone the messages from my daughter's middle school about how they're not going to really do class tomorrow because we're all going to take in this really solemn and very important historic ceremony and stuff. I'm kind of feeling a lot of like, nope, not this time. Is it my incipient midlife grumpiness talking, Catherine?
Incipient.
Yeah, I was going to say well-established. My midlife grumpiness is incipient. Yours is well-established.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, Inauguration Day has always made me a little grumpy. I don't like, in general, we don't do royalty in this country except maybe like today a little bit vibe. Don't love that. As always, the musical performances do rip holes in our hearts with their deep, deep, abysmal.
Where are the Capitol steps when you need
them? The poet laureate this year, the poet laureate who's delivering the inaugural poem, which is a thing that's also shouldn't be a thing, is 22. So I'm like, speaking of midlife, like that doesn't seem like a good idea to me. And yeah, I mean, in general, like I, despite not voting, love me some election day as a concept. Do not love Inauguration Day. And when Joe Biden stands up there and says, blah, 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 unity, it's the only thing he can say. But it's not, it's so far from being resonant with where the country is right now. And the idea that the president can kind of do these speech acts and like make it so is always most present on Inauguration Day. It declines from there, thankfully.
I thankfully haven't seen, maybe because I'm just not reading enough, a lot of really bad Thomas L. Friedman style punditry of like, here's what the president should write in his speech. Which is like the
I've seen like parody ones already. I've only seen like the joking version of that thing. So maybe that's a good sign for America. We're skipping right to parody.
Nick, there's a like for the State of the Union address, Gene Healy especially has pointed out that used to be just kind of like a note from your parents between George Washington and Woodrow Wilson, and Wilson decided to make it a big thing and whatever. So like the remedy for the State of the Union address, which no one will take, is nonetheless kind of obvious, which is stop making a big speech with a lot of applause and the ripping up and whatever. Just like knock it off, write the letter from Epstein's mom and be done with it. Is there any like similar fix that we can do for the inauguration? What's the Gillespie inauguration? Obviously, the poet is going to be Marcel Marceau. We've got that. But like what can we do to de-pompify
the ghost
this
of Gigi Allen?
Oh, yeah.
I would, you know, I think that we're doing that, you know, just as the Democratic National Convention took place on a soundstage, this is essentially an inauguration without an audience, certainly a live audience. I am a big fan of what my ex-wife actually in her academic work talked about the how does a republic have a common culture, a spectacular culture that people go to. This was something that the 17th century revolutionaries in England dealt with. And the thing is, you know, ideally you turn it way down. So you have fewer events and they take less time and certainly less public resources. And they are not pageants the way that aristocratic or monarchical societies or, you know, tin pot dictatorships tend to be. And I think we're kind of getting there with this inauguration. Because literally, basically, nobody's going to be able to go. Kamala will be able to wear her Chuck Taylors because it's a dress down event this time around. So that's all good. I would go back to the inaugural address, though. It can be important. And when we go back and if we look at what Trump said in his initial one, where he talked about, or, you know, his only one, when he talked about American carnage, that set the tone. And it was a meaningful kind of encapsulation of, you know, where he was at. I do think that Biden, I don't expect him to do this, but there is a moment where, like, we don't have to live in a country that is absolutely polarized all of the time on all of the things. And Biden could say something to that effect, and he could enact policies that, you know, conjure up Lincoln's second inaugural, where, you know, we're talking about charity towards all and malice towards none. I don't think that that's going to happen because there are a lot of reasons why that won't happen. But it would be nice to see something like that. But shorter, smaller, and quicker.
I think maybe one way of thinking about it is that I will be allergic to just the sound of the word unity coming out of Joe Biden's mouth. And yet he kind of has to say that. So why not? Peter, let's get to the act.
No, but this is just very quickly. I mean, if he did policies that actually, shot towards the middle of things that really need to change. And that doesn't mean giving everybody even more money that we can't afford for things that we don't need. But rather, you know, if he did do things like, dismantling the drug war, if he did, you know, he's pledged to reverse a bunch of immigration policies. That's, you know, these are all good things. Like he can actually talk about and enact policies that are, you know, that have 60, 70, 80%, consensus in America. That would be a start.
Peter, building on what Nick was just talking about, let's get to the actual policies that the new president wants to enact. Last week, he rolled out a new $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. This goes on top of the previous $4 trillion or so, I think, that we've either spent or decided not to take in taxes from the federal level since March of last year. What's in that bad boy package, Peter? If you could also give a sense of what actually pertains to curbing, ending the pandemic.
So I just want to start by saying that I think Lady Gaga should be the poet laureate and that we shouldn't have any distinction there, right?
Actually,
I want your horror.
It can't be
I want
worse.
Your design. If you're a criminal, as long as you're mine, I want your love. That's poetry.
Nope. Take it back. So as soon as you started reading Lady Gaga lyrics, I remembered that the answer actually is no.
I want your psycho,
no!
Your vertigo shtick.
Stop it!
Oh, it's so good. No, I'm incredibly moved here looking at these lyrics. The relief package, maybe not so much. So I think the right way to look at this is to put it in the context of the series of bills that we have seen passed over the last year. And the last time we did a big rundown of these, I compared them, I think, to the Marvel Cinematic Universe phases. And I will spare you all of that this time. But there's a little bit of overlap here still, I think. Right. So we started with like $100 billion or so and kind of some stuff. A little bit was directed to hospitals and maybe, you know, sort of taking care of people. And then we did the CARES Act. And that was the really big one. That was $2.2 trillion at the end of March. And then we did the CARES Act again. We just topped it up with almost $700 billion more in additional spending, mostly for the small business funds there. And then we spent the summer arguing about whether to do $1 trillion or 2 trillion, as maybe House Republicans, Senate Republicans, and the Trump administration wanted to do, or 3.3 trillion, which is what House Democrats wanted. And then what we ended up doing was in December, everybody got together and passed a $900 billion package. So that is about $3.7 trillion spent on COVID relief and associated stuff over the past year or so. And so Biden is coming in having with a government that has already spent really unprecedented amounts of money on this. And his first big act he has announced, as you said, is to push forward with a $1.9 trillion American Rescue Act. And the thing that I want to say before we even get into what's into that is that he is out there telling people already that this is part one of two, that there is a second bill that is going to come that is going to be maybe not exactly as big, but just as kind of big in thought and scale. And right, like they haven't announced a price tag or exactly what's going to be in it. But the idea is this is the bill that's going to address the pandemic for the most part and sort of get us over the hump. And then the next one is going to address the economy specifically. And so you asked what the pandemic parts of this are, and that is mainly a $400 billion set of programs for vaccinations, testing, and public health workers, right? So Biden wants to hire 100,000 public health workers, increase test capacity, develop a national test and trace regime. He also wants to send some money to schools. And the idea here is you get the infrastructure set up, you vaccinate teachers, and that can get schools back online. I think Biden is trying to straddle the line between why aren't teachers just working right now? Everyone should be back in school right now. And we should be back in school, but we got to spend a lot of money to get us there, right? And so that's sort of where he's going to end up.
What's he straddling?
Well, I think there's a movement on the left, especially amongst teachers unions, to say you should be spending a lot more money and we shouldn't be going back to school. And Biden is kind of saying, well, we'll spend the money, but we need to get kids back in classrooms right now. And then there's a bunch of other money that the administration is casting as direct relief. This is basically payments to people, right? So there was a $600 check for everyone in the $900 billion bill that passed last month. That was just last month. Like, remember, this was not long ago, even though it feels like eons. And they're going to raise that to $2,000, so an additional $1,400. There's been some debate about whether that's going to be an additional $2,000 or not, right, to make it a full $2,000 check. But at least as initially packaged, it's an additional $1,400. They're going to expand the boost to unemployment insurance to $400 a week. They're going to spend $30 billion on rental assistance, more money for food stamps and stuff like that. This is just a throw money at everything bill. And remember, like I said, it is part one of two. And this comes out of two sort of schools of Democratic thought. One is that when Barack Obama came into office in 2009 and was facing the recession, what he tried to do was to have a bipartisan package that Republicans were going to sign on to. And, you know, he especially tried to do this then after the stimulus bill with the Affordable Care Act. And what Republicans did was they just delayed and slowed everything down and then never signed on. So it comes from the idea that Republicans are never going to sign on to any of this. You don't really need to worry about them. Just do the stuff you want to do. And second, it comes from a thinking that is not modern monetary theory itself. It's not exactly MMT, but it is sort of MMT adjacent. Call it deficit dovery, which just argues that interest rates are so low right now. And because they are so low, we can just sort of borrow with abandon. And that view is being promoted by a whole bunch of the kind of center-left wonks, as well as folks like Janet Yellen, who used to be at the Fed and is headed to run the Treasury, who's going to say in a speech this week, "Neither the president-elect nor I propose this relief package without an appreciation for the country's debt burden. But right now, with interest rates at historic lows, the smartest thing we can do is act big." And that is more than anything else, just the kind of the defining aspect of this bill and of Biden's initial economic policy push is interest rates are low. Money is basically free.
Let's act big and spend as much of it as we can right now.
We'll follow up on that kind of macro and debt thing in a second with Nick. But first, Catherine, I wanted to get you to tell us anything on the micro level, an aspect of this bill that particularly gives you the heebies, or maybe you love it. Who knows?
Maybe. No, I actually was just distracted by the fact that that phrase act big for some reason just like fully made me think of, you know, like in Planet Earth or whatever, like anything narrated by David Attenborough when like a bird like puffs up so that it will like seem scary to so that it won't be eaten. Like that's us, I think.
This is economic policy peacocking.
Yeah. Oh, yuck.
I think that's better than domestic dovery or debt dovery.
No, look, there are deficit hawks and there are deficit doves, and deficit doves are distinct from the MMT group who don't really have like a meaningful theory and basically think that like you can spend as much money as you want forever, and the only real constraint is inflation, and even that is sort of fake. When is inflation actually happening?
Just talking word choice.
Deficit doves.
Just word choice.
Deficit doves.
Just the word.
Are a real distinct faction.
They are. That's true.
Go, Catherine.
I want to talk about the eviction moratorium extension, because this is something that, you know, in the midst of all these hundreds of billions of trillions of dollars, it can be easy to miss out on how some of these like details are actually would be like the biggest legislation in the country at a normal time. And there's already an eviction moratorium that's been in place. Let's all just remember it was put in place by the CDC. Like that was a thing that happened. And we were just like, okay, that seems fair. Like, what?
America's landlord.
No, absolutely not. The CDC has not covered itself in glory. It can't be in charge of the housing market. That can't be a thing we do. But apparently Joe Biden would like to extend that moratorium for an additional 8 months, which, you know, that's September. Like, unless something really goes even more wrong than all the things that have already gone wrong, which, you know, 2021, we'll see how it goes. But
it's going so great so far.
The entire rest of society really should be largely back on track by then. The idea that in September, we will once again re-ask the question, can the owners of properties manage them in any way? Can they actually evict people? This seems frankly insane to me. There's also foreclosures.
That also pushes us up against cold weather season,
yes,
which is notable.
Which
because
I know you can't evict people in the cold weather, and there there are places where that's illegal already.
Yes, you have to have like a certain number of days of above 60 degree no rain weather.
Correct.
If you want to evict someone.
So this is, I mean, you know, I think if we are worried about how people are going to find housing, if we are worried about, you know, where are people going to live in this new economy that we are about to enter that is going to be reshaped radically by COVID? One thing we could do here is let prices fall. Like, markets are actually good at handling this problem. I know that this is like a very, very, very hot and contested issue, but it seems crazy to me that we have just decided the answer is like, actually, the CDC owns everyone's apartment. And we just have to wait till they say that we can make changes in terms of contractual agreements that have to do with housing. If everyone was allowed to run their own business, then I genuinely think it would be better not only for the landlords, but for people who need places to live. There are plenty of people right now who need somewhere to live, and there are plenty of apartments whose prices are stuck and whose tenants are stuck in them. And the end of this process is not going to be more cheap housing. So, you know, the CDC should not be running housing, is I guess what I'm saying here. Just a little note for Joe Biden in case he's listening.
What about disease control? Should they be getting out of
that business? Probably also not that, TBH, no. But like, let's get the low hanging fruit.
You've just activated a PTSD trigger in my brain that I was in a band 25 or so years ago in which there was a song, didn't write it with a lyric. I know a cat named Chairman Mao. He's so cool. He owns my house. Think about it. Nick, building on Peter's...
There's some poet laureate material.
Yeah, screw Lady Gaga and also like that 22-year-old.
It's a little early for group therapy.
And that man works for the State Department. Nick, your friend, Washington Post columnist E.J. Dion, wrote today that, quote, the economic relief package Joe Biden has proposed shows that Democrats have learned from the Obama years, that excessive caution in the face of a severe economic downturn creates sluggish growth, a mistake for both policy and politics, unquote. Is EJ right, or is he totally right?
Yeah, he's, well, let's put it this way. Economics don't enter into it, but politically, he's probably onto something. And this is something, you know, when Obama was talking about a $700 trillion, $800 trillion stimulus.
It was about $750 billion in 2009, and it's adjusted, inflation adjusted, about $950 billion now.
So it was, you know, that was jaw-dropping. And even when George W. Bush early in 2008 dropped $100 billion stimulus through some kind of tax giveaways and free checks to people, you know, these were large numbers. They don't matter anymore. And I think that's what Biden, I think that's what a lot of people in the political space are thinking about now is, you know, if you go back and you look at the trend lines of Trump in terms of spending, and in terms of debt, there's a kind of pretty straight line upward, you know, trend line that's just going up where we're spending more, we are getting in debt more and more. And then COVID came along and really took the lid off of any kind of spending restraint whatsoever. And so in a way, I think this is all going to be, you know, it's like doing a cocaine binge. It seems like a great idea to keep doing more and more and scrounging around to find more money to snort more cocaine and more cocaine. Tomorrow will never come. And the bigger the binge, the, you know, the longer the recovery period. And that's what we're going to see. But politically, this is a sweet spot for this. And they, you know, we're the Overton window, you know, is at the OTB office, and it's just, you know, money is just flying out the
window.
And
as Nick has written about a lot in the past, there's a significant economics literature that contends that if you have a debt load above 90% of GDP, then you start to be a measurable drag on economic growth, like directly to the contrary of what E.J. Dionne writes. And we are so far beyond that, and will be for the rest of all of our lifetimes, at least until the great default. I would also just add that Peter referenced it earlier. Biden's plan calls for $170 billion to assist in reopening schools. And also $350 billion bailout for the states. And you can imagine that one of the items that will be bailed out by the states is school budget. It's worth pointing out that on an annual basis, pretty much consistently back through time, the federal government spends about $40 billion on K through 12 education because that's mostly a local issue. So what we do is spend $40 billion a year. And then when there's a crisis, we throw $170 billion to, you know, much more in there. And it's another, not quite the CDC controls your rent level, but it is the federalization of everything. And it's to my mind, it's troubling. There's another aspect of the bill, which I think Peter mentioned, but which gets us.
There's so many aspects.
We'll be talking about this for a while, certainly. But this gets us to our email of the week, to the Reason Roundtable. Brand newish feature that we have here. People can send them to roundtable@reason.com. Include how you want your name to be mispronounced and or any Twitter handle. This comes from Justin Anderson. Says, I live in Florida. I'm sorry, Justin. And I was already dreading the passage of the $15 an hour minimum wage, which is in this bill. Apparently, Biden wants everywhere in the country to have a $15 per hour minimum wage, whether you're in Mississippi, where a living wage is $48,537. I love the specificity. Or in Hawaii, where apparently similar cost of living is $108,110.25. My job, Justin writes, is to automate people's work, so business will be good for me. But unless I can get my kids skilled up on IT delivery by the time they are freshmen, they're not going to have jobs in high school, nor are a bunch of other people. My question is, if he passes this, are there any plans for what the next $15 an hour will be? $20 an hour? $30 an hour? Or are we just jumping straight to a UBI? What say you, Catherine Mangue Ward?
In some ways, I would almost prefer to jump straight to a UBI because that would distort our economy less. Like, To be clear, I do not want us to have a UBI. I don't think that would be a great idea. Or rather, it might be a great idea if we did it instead of literally everything else that we're doing ever, always, which we won't. But yeah, I mean, this is...
We might do it in addition to all
right,
the things
so
we're doing.
Right, so a hard no to that one. But yeah, the minimum wage debate has always been... I've always struggled with this exact question, which is like the $15 number is totally just a made up number, right? Like there's some, you know, there's some like retroactive justification of it, but it really is just kind of a number that people in expensive cities sort of pulled out of their asses to say, this sounds like maybe it would be okay, sort of the right number for the poors to have without being too poor. And as our friend Justin points out, that number means something radically different in different places in the country. It's almost like maybe wage levels shouldn't be set at the federal level. It's almost like maybe there isn't one right wage or wage floor for the entire country, and that at the very, very least, this should be a state or local issue. But in fact, it should maybe be done, I don't know, on an employer by employer basis. We could call it free markets. We could just do that. Like, that would be a way to set wages. And, you know, again, I think there's a whole bunch of other moving pieces in here, which people are right to object to, including why is healthcare tied to your employment? And how does that affect wages? Huge, important question that is sometimes obscured by the very, very, very simple slogan-tastic $15 an hour, the end. Pitch, which obviously Joe Biden and Democrats like and are going to keep pushing. But yes, that number can only go up. Minimum wages don't go down. They're not going to go down. And I think that, you know, we need to be really cognizant of that, that this is a classic ratchet. Then there will be no going back from it.
You know, I'm going to fact check you, Catherine. They go down when they're frozen over time and inflation robs
the fiat currency. Thank you.
Of value. Sir.
Thank you. You're right. You're right, actually. But
Peter, you have written, and maybe refresh us briefly, as you like to do, how the $15 an hour number is not just pulled out of orifices. It's based on an economic paper whose authors then immediately followed up with like, but hold on, don't do that. If you did this on a federal. No, stop it. Do you remember that? You wrote about it.
Yeah. So the $15 an hour number is actually an increase over the number that we saw in that paper that you're talking about. Basically, there was some research that was done a decade or so ago that looked at minimum wage increases across state lines in a select number of, I believe, restaurant type environments, and found that over the studied period of time, when one state raised its minimum wage and the other state didn't, it didn't cause any job losses in the state that raised its minimum wage, right? In the restaurants that they looked at, right? They tried to create a sort of, this is what's called a synthetic control, right? You can't do it to the same restaurants twice. So you do it to comparable restaurants in related geographic areas that are roughly the same economically. And so they created a synthetic control, and from this said, well, look, you raised the minimum wage. It doesn't have any effect on jobs. And of course, it didn't actually say that. It was a somewhat narrower study that looked, like I said, at this sort of at just a couple of counties. And it wasn't $15 an hour at that point. It was either 10 or I believe $12 an hour.
12, I think. Yeah.
Yes, I believe. I'm pretty sure it was 12. And so from this, the Democratic political establishment has extrapolated the idea that any minimum wage increase anywhere at any time to pretty much any amount will never cost jobs, which is a completely crazy idea. And so, and also just not in line with mainstream economics at all. I mean, the Congressional Budget Office, which takes into account the research showing that older research that I was pointing to, showing that there weren't job losses in this studied area, still says that an increase to $15 would cost about 3.7 million jobs while lifting something like 17 million people, while raising the wages of about 17 million people here. But I think there's two other things that we should look at here. One is just remember the CARES Act. That's the big stimulus bill that passed in March, the $2.2 trillion bill that passed just last year, right after the lockdowns happened. And that bill raised the federal unemployment insurance boost. It gave a $600 a week boost. $600 a week was not an accident. That is 40 hours of $15 an hour work. And that was a deliberate sort of setup for pushing a $15 an hour wage through federally. And so this was the plan all along. And this has been sort of, this has been intended by the Democratic policy establishment, at least since March, which of course has been looking for a way to pass this for a lot longer. The other thing that I would say though is a minimum wage is a really bad way to, if what you want to do is use government policy and even spend some money to make people better off, a minimum wage increase is not a great way to do it. Because first of all, it does cost some jobs. And while it does increase the wages of some people, and some people will be paid more, the typical minimum wage earner in a lot of cases is a high school kid, is not somebody who is the hardworking, you know, single parent with a couple of kids who is struggling to get by on $7.25 an hour. And the other thing that a $15 minimum wage does is that it really complicates things for restaurants, which, if you haven't been paying attention, have been just completely screwed over the last
year.
Fine.
We don't need to worry about the restaurants.
Yeah, because
they're
restaurants
doing good.
Often pay people less than minimum wage and then make that up. Servers can make actually quite a bit more through the tips. And so this was a reason that a lot of the restaurant industry and servers, when DC tried to push through a $15 an hour minimum wage, opposed it. It was because it would have, in fact, been bad for the people it was trying to help. And I think we should really take those concerns into account here with this push for a federal $15 minimum wage.
Nick, go ahead.
I think there's a larger, one of the larger points to tease out of all of this is that at a time when government should be acting more surgically to help people who are hurting, right? I realize on this podcast I may be in the minority of saying, you know, that government has a role, particularly in moments of extreme stress, to help people, you know, through transfer payments and things like that. But if you take that for granted, we should be delivering aid and comfort to people who need it. And the idea of raising the minimum wage, and as Peter's talking about, if you look at people who earn the minimum wage, what level of income household they belong to, it's spread out across the five quintiles. Like you cannot pick a minimum wage worker and then predict from that, are they poor or are they rich? They're in both places in the same way. And what we should be doing is helping people who need money. And everything that is going into the CARES Act or went into the CARES Act, so much more stuff before that is completely independent of that. And that extends to other popular programs like getting rid of student loan debt, which would overwhelmingly help people who are in health in wealthy households. The minimum wage these are blunt instruments at a time when the government should be going to people who are poor or who are starving or who are homeless and saying, here is something to help you get back on your feet. And instead, in the name of helping those people, the people in power, and sometimes it's Republicans, most of the time it's Democrats, are saying we're going to be really generous and we're just going to give people massive amounts of money in order to help the poorest among us, even though the main beneficiaries are people who are doing quite well. And that's one of the weird backstories of the lockdown, is that many people, many households' balance sheets have never been better because they're getting a bunch of free money from the government. They're not spending as much. If they are lucky enough to continue to have their jobs, things are well. And this is why this, you know, all of this stuff is, it's a 20th century model of dumb governance at the exact moment when we really need to be doing things on a much more kind of focused and localized and individualized level.
You can lump those big checks that are being sent out to most households into this bucket as well. It's just a big, dumb, non-targeted program that sends money to everybody.
Thank you, Justin, for the email. This is the last 24 hours or so, as we were recording, of Donald Trump's presidency. Believe it or not, unless there's, you know, unless Cube finally delivers, I think we're in for the MyPillow coup didn't work out. So that's it. And the last kind of great question is what Donald Trump will do with his considerable power to pardon or commute the sentences of people who have been sentenced in the federal system. The reporting as we speak right now is that there are expected to be somewhere around 100 pardons and or commutations today. It's probable that many of them will happen between the time that we record this and the time that it comes out. It's just the perils of doing live broadcasting, man, although it's not live. Anyways, so let's just do a quick round of hopes and fears of what we might see the rest of these next 24 hours. Catherine, do you want to start what you hope and or fear will happen with Trump's pardons and commutations?
As I have said many times on this podcast, I really hope that Russ Albrecht manages to sneak into that list. I think that the Silk Road founder, entrepreneur, and person who is serving just an ungodly sentence, absolutely deserving of clemency, and has been rumored to be on various short lists. I would love to see that. What I fear is that instead, the outgoing president will use his clemency powers purely or largely for self-serving political gain, including perhaps experimenting with the novel self-pardon or pardoning his entire family, and also like the guy that makes him those taco bowls or whatever is going on over there. I can only assume that this list is going to cause everyone to do hopefully one last just like scream of outrage about how shambolic and messy and self-serving and theatrical the entire Trump presidency has been. I hope it's the last one. It would be the best case scenario if the last Trump freakout is about these pardons and then he just leaves town quietly.
Peter?
All the stuff that Catherine said. I mean, I hope that he doesn't use his pardon power primarily to pardon himself or his cronies. And I hope that he uses it to pardon a bunch of deserving people. I'm also excited about the prospect of a Lil Wayne pardon, just so that we could maybe get the Carter Six, you know?
Lil Wayne on a, his crime is a kind of bullshit weapons charge for the most part. So that would be interesting. If he's pardoning rappers, I hope he does a posthumous pardon for Dee Dee Ramone, who went through an unfortunate rap phase in the late 80s. As Dee Dee
God,
King.
That would be a cult. That'd be a, that would be artistic nice, pardon,
but then,
right?
You know, the, yes, the other kind of high profile people, I think that would be fantastic and would send a message building off the Ross Ulbricht pardon would be Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, and Reality Winner. I would love, you know, and I, this is sheer fantasy, but it would be great if we could have in the, you know, we're talking about a domestic terrorism law. We are talking about, you know, more and more surveillance. People are calling for, you know, an expansion of the FCC to regulate cable and the internet again, content and things like this that are insane. And I think a great starting point would be to really put on the table what went wrong with our national intelligence programs and surveillance of illegal and even fully legal surveillance of American citizens over the past 20 years since the war on terror really brought that issue to the fore. And so going after or giving pardons to people like Snowden, Assange, and Winner would really set the table for a very overdue conversation. And again, to get back to this issue of blunt force government versus, you know, surgical government, you know, part of the problem with surveillance is like it is being used, it covers everybody instead of actually focusing on people who might pose some sort of threat. In every aspect of our life, Matt, and I know as the co-author of a book called The Declaration of Independence, you'll be nodding along either in sleep or in some kind of robo-tripping. It is the morning after a holiday weekend. But, you know, what we need, we have mass personalization, mass individualization. of virtually everything in every aspect of our lives except government services, and that's where we need to drag that carcass across the finish.
My fears about the pardon, aside from what has been expressed before, and also Sheldon Silver, who's just, he's like, there's not a single person in this.
You should explain who
not
he
really,
is.
A former speaker of the Assembly, of longtime power broker in New York state politics. And in a state where politics is corrupt by design, is notable for his extra super triple corruption. And like, there's not a single person who's not named Donald Trump who wants to see him pardoned or commuted. Like, this, the expression of revulsion about that, about the possibility is pretty remarkable and very, you know, unanimous and bipartisan. Unity, Nick.
Do you think it would be good if Trump said, you know what, I'm going to pardon Andrew Cuomo? Or just start like throwing shade by giving people proactive pardons.
Troll pardons. Yeah. Donald Trump pioneering
troll pardons for all of the deaths that he caused.
It probably wouldn't be the first troll pardon. Like, I am not a historian of the presidential pardon, but I bet you that this, like, somebody has had this idea before and probably put it into action in some glorious way. But yes, Trump as the popularizer of the troll pardon seems like something that unfortunately we just don't have time for anymore, but he could have really leaned into it.
But my fear is actually that the revulsion by the kind of political class at whatever horrors Trump unleashes. And to be clear, every president in the last 24 hours or so of his presidency does a controversial pardon or commutation or two, including many that reek of kind of self-dealing or corruption. There's a lot of reporting now that there's people being paid or offering services to, you know, help get cases up for pardoning. And I'm sure that happens before, but as usual with Trump, it's more gross and more direct and probably more corrupt. But anyways, my fear is that people are going to say, well, you know, this finally shows we need to curtail the president's pardon power and commutation power. Obviously, I think that's the exact wrong.
You're just always raising the worst case scenario for us, aren't you? Thank you, Matt, for that.
I've seen, you know, if you for the 90 seconds that I can tolerate watching cable news, you know, that there's always some expert on to basically say that, you know, like to shake their damn head at Donald Trump. And how can we make law and policy even worse as a result of him? That's just all over the news right now.
What America needs is less mercy.
What I would like to see, and I've been hitting this for a while, is that pardoning shouldn't be a last 24 hours of a 4-year presidency. It should be every Friday or maybe like every day. Like, stop making it this sort of like a ritual of corruption or last minute frenzy. You know, the Obama administration, which talked a lot about criminal justice belatedly in his second term, only really got around to commuting and pardoning in his last year in office. Why? Don't do that anymore. If Joe Biden and Kamala Harris came in, despite their long track record of being cops, who wrote the Patriot Act, among other things, and wrote the Death Penalty Act, Immigration and Anti-Death Penalty or Pro-Death Penalty Act of 1996, all of these tough on crime activities, but they both campaigned despite their long records about being criminal justice reformers. Great. Here's an idea. Pardon someone every day or every week who should no longer be rotting in jail for laws that were passed in a frenzy of illiberal tough on crimeism back in the day. So that's what my hopes and fears are, all in one tidy package.
I should do it on Substack. Just like set up like pardonus.substack.com.
Be a Patreon, but would you have to pay, or would it be a free subscription?
I mean, I think you'd get it early if you paid, and then you'd find out, you know, Friday at noon, right? So you get it like Thursday night if you were a subscriber.
So it drops for subscribers first, paying subscribers.
But Joe Biden has really, like, he's leaned into this "I'm not on Twitter" type thing, right? He's got a Twitter account, but he's just like, I don't pay attention to Twitter. And that's Substack's brand as well, is like, you know, I think their slogan's "Take Back Your Mind."
Is
can
it really?
I, at the risk of having an extended conversation about
French
this,
goodbye.
Do you guys worry at all about Biden's sanity? Like, that he's got all his marbles.
This is the Frenchest goodbye this podcast has ever seen. You're like,
well,
apropos,
we've got time
like
to kill.
I'm worried
I'm
about
glad you think so.
Your sanity now.
I mean that
I'm
conversation
about his
has
deeply...
kind of faded. Is it because it was made up, or is it because nobody really wants to touch that hot stuff?
They both were crypt keepers, and there was nothing to do about it. But I'm worried about his crappy mainstream authoritarianism. We'll talk about the sanity later if it manifests.
I mean, I think the problem with the he's losing his marbles charge is not that necessarily. That it's wrong that an old man is stumbling through some things and he might be on the cognitive down slope. It's just that in the context of a presidential election, it was him against someone who's close to his age and who lies his face off every day. And it's like, what's so like people thought of it in those terms. It was being weaponized by lying face over here. And so it's not that it's wrong or not worrisome. But like, you know, I don't know what the Maslow's hierarchy of needs means. I think it's probably claptrap. But like on the hierarchy of things over the last 2 months, for example, it's like Biden's cognitive abilities on one hand, Trump saying stop the steal and lying about things on a daily basis, eventually culminating in a deadly riot on Capitol Hill on the other hand. So I think people, I don't like to weigh things on a scale like that. Yes, it's a great topic of conversation for next week. And as the Nick French goodbyes tend to do, we shall take that with seriousness in a more extended discussion next week. And with that, I will clop that down and let's go to our end of podcast. What you have been consuming, starting with Nick Gillespie.
I watched Solar Opposites, which is a animated cartoon show on Hulu from Justin Roiland, or he's one of the co-creators. He who is also the co-creator of Rick and Morty. Solar Opposites is similar. If you liked Rick and Morty, you will like Solar Opposites. If you disliked Rick and Morty, I think you will like Solar Opposites. It's a funny show about a kind of alien family unit, for lack of a better term, that lands on Earth and has to try and fix their ship and get off before Earth is destroyed by another character on the show. It's funny, it's mean, it's dark, but it's more Morty and less Rick. So I highly recommend it. It's an imaginative kind of counterfactual of life on this miserable planet.
Suderman, what have you been consuming?
I've been watching WandaVision on Disney Plus. So it's the first of a series of television shows in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? So it's an expansion of the kind of Avengers world of movies. And it's it is coming here. It's been a little bit delayed because of the pandemic. And it was it's sort of the first in an onslaught of shows like this, not just in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but also a bunch of Star Wars shows. So at an investor conference at the end of last year, Disney announced that they were doing something like 10 new Marvel superhero shows and 10 new Star Wars series. And each one of these things was going to cost, you know, a gazillion, bazillion dollars each and be sort of cinematic quality, even though they were going to be 35-minute episodes doled out in, you know, doled out on television each week. And so what I want to do is I just want to end by saying that, in fact, we're still in like stimulus comparison here, because what Disney is doing is what Joe Biden is doing, is just saying we're going to spend all the money on all the things and roll it out in a pandemic-y fashion, right? Like, instead of doing it in theaters, which are closed, we're just going to deliver it direct to your home. And we're going to, I'm basically a neoliberal, but for Disney franchises, is what I'm saying.
Peter, each episode is a parody of a sitcom, right?
Yeah. It's a kind of clever sitcom parody. The first two episodes are available now, and they are very, very reminiscent of Dick Van Dyke and I Dream of Jeannie in particular. They're in black and white, right? And it's the idea is you've got these two characters from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Vision and Scarlet Witch, or Wanda Maximoff, both of whom are like mystical super characters, except they're stuck in this very like old-timey sitcom environment, and they can't quite figure out why, and it's sort of goofy. And it is a reminder that part of Marvel's genius and charm is to wrap all of their superhero stuff in the form of genre, right? So you had The Winter Soldier, which was the second Captain America movie, and it is very much like a 70s spy film, except kind of elevated and expanded into a modern blockbuster with superheroes. You have Guardians of the Galaxy, which is just sort of Star Wars again, and arguably better than the new Star Wars films that Disney put out, and that Kevin Feige, who is the head of the MCU and kind of the meta showrunner for all of these products, has always really been interested in packaging these things as genre products, not just in the superhero genre kind of alone, but in sort of rethinking sort of Hollywood history. And it does a really nice job here. It's like a shockingly good, not even a parody of old Dick Van Dyke and I Dream of Jeannie type shows, but like a loving homage to those shows that, like, if you are someone like me who grew up with Nick at Night and watching them in reruns as a kid, you will very much appreciate how much it draws from them and how much it gets at the appeal of those shows.
Catherine,
is there a Hogan's Heroes episode? That's what we all want.
Let's just leave that rhetorically. Catherine, what have you been consuming?
I have been consuming Sea Shanty Talk, and I want to talk about that. Don't you grumble at me. I listen to your dumb stuff. Okay, so here's what's happening on TikTok right now. The kids these days are into sea shanties, which is like, it's a great development. Somebody recorded just a single track of himself singing a song about a Wellerman, which, as far as I can understand, the Wellerman is like the bodega of the sea. Like, if you're out there catching whales, the Wellerman comes out in his ship to bring you sugar and tea and rum, which you need because you're grappling a whale. Needless to say, the convergence of Shanty Talk and my Moby Dick reading project has been incredible. So I am just hanging out, listening to sea shanties like a teen and reading about whales. If you have been reluctant to get on TikTok, this is honestly your way in. This is like, it's got something for dads. It's got something for teens. It's got something for people who are moved by music, who I hear are prevalent in the population. And it's just delightful. It's also a great reminder that, like, the internet is something we do together. People are like, oh no, don't have the screen time. It's so bad. The kids these days don't talk to each other in person. Y'all, there's the way that it has worked is that people have built on these individual people singing until you get this like very moving, glorious, collaborative chorus of people singing. People have got their freaking fiddles out. The lyrics are on the screen. There's an EDM version of it somehow. It's just like, I really can't say enough that it's like a source of joy, and like, technology is good and Moby Dick is good, and I'm just really, really enjoying Shanty Talk and commend it to you.
Does this make you want to go back and watch Star Trek IV, the one about the whales?
It does not, but you know what? I got somehow in my feed, I got a Star Trek parody of the Wellerman song. That is, someone has rewritten all the lyrics and sung it, but Star Trek stuff, and I didn't understand any of it because, as you know, I'm not a Trekkie, but again, the internet is good and bountiful.
In that Star Trek movie too, James Doohan Scotty is actually bigger than several of the whales. Thank you, Catherine. You actually did a very good job of selling the sea shanty revival moment. And it reminds me that some of the earliest kind of recordings, when that became popular, people preserved sea shanties because it's a remarkably vibrant and adaptable kind of format.
I also learned that there are lady sea shanties, which are weaving songs, where you, instead of using like the sounds of like sailor activities, you use the sounds of, you know, looming to sing songs to coordinate. So like, what I'm saying here is like, hi, Virginia Pastorelle, how you doing?
Yeah. Speaking of, no, In my never-ending march through listening to absolutely every single bit of recorded music output from the year 1989, finally worked my way through December of 1989 and listened to a record that I should have, by dint of my Gen X-ness, have listened to 1,000 years ago, but just didn't manage to do it, which is the first solo record by the drummer for Husker Du, Grant Hart, who is always my favorite Husker, the classic Minneapolis post-punk band. Drummer, co-songwriter, sang some songs, usually my favorite ones in that band. He has a record out called came out with a record in December 89 called Intolerance. Catherine used the word shambolic in a different context earlier. It's kind of a shambolic record. It's messy. The drumming time doesn't hold up. It's usually, you know, it's about heroin and breaking up with Husker Du and being mad at Bob Mould and all the usual things that you would imagine if you were familiar with the work of the artist in question. And yet it is just kind of great. Something about his voice totally gets me. There's great instrumental track on there called Roller Rink that is just like a big organ. And somehow it's one of the most moving songs that I've heard in the last 6 months. And just fun.
Does it have anything to do with Rollerball? That old action movie?
It's more just evocative of a thing that was already kind of... no, it's not that. It's
Matt. Yes. I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead. Finish. You go ahead. Ask me.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, part of drama of Grant Hart too was that he had been living under a misdiagnosis of being HIV positive.
Correct.
At a time when that meant certain death, and he realized he learned that his diagnosis was wrong.
Yeah.
Just as Husker Du was ending, and that enlivens and both deadens his work. A phenomenal solo career. And he also would eventually or quickly, to tie it into Catherine's love, he released an album with Nova Mob called Admiral of the Sea. So it's...
There we damn go.
He's as deep as the, full fathom five as the Marianas Trench of the... Wild Pacific.
And he's one of
What's
these
the entry point for Husker Du, for the whole Husker Du universe, expanded
Nick and I
universe
will,
of artists
Nick and I
here.
Will probably disagree with that, but the general canon records are New Day Rising, Zen Arcade, mm-hmm. and for me my favorite is Candy Apple Gray, but that's a minority view.
That sounds just about right.
I would just start with their cover of 8 Miles High, which is the only cover of that song I think that fully grasps what was going on there. It's just a great like punk yell and fun. It's just actually my biggest complaint of Husker Du over the years is the sound of the snare. It's just sort of like caught in this 80s loop of compression that I hate. And that's not evident on the drummer's solo record. It's actually a pretty good sounding snare for whatever that's worth. But anyways, that's all of the time we have here on the Reason Roundtable. Again, please send us your emails. We love reading and responding and talking about stuff. Roundtable@reason.com is how you get there. You get to all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. These include and are also limited to the recent interview with Nick Gillespie and the Soho Forum with Gene Epstein and the Family Stone. And that's it. We have a nice inauguration, and we will see you next Monday. Goodbye.